everyone, and thanks for listening to Lit Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Teja. On this episode, we are joined by Lit Publishing's first author, Kevin Duncan. We will talk about the 10th anniversary edition of his best-selling title, The Diagrams Book. Kevin is a business advisor, marketing expert, motivational speaker, and author. After 20 years in advertising, he has spent the last 24 as an independent troubleshooter advising companies on how to change their businesses for the better. He's the author of numerous business books, including the Smart Thinking book and the Ideas book. The Diagrams book is a classic. Kevin has spent a decade collecting the world's most helpful diagrams, and here is the result. Over 100,000 copies and 15 translations later, this 10th anniversary edition contains 100 diagrams, 50 of them new from the original. Well, welcome back to the Lit Radio Podcast, Kevin. It's a great pleasure to have you with us once again. And this time, the reason for you to be with us is the 10th anniversary of your first book with Lit, the Diagrams book. So my first question to you is, how did you start using diagrams in the first place?
Yes, well, the history of this goes back a long, long, long way, really, to when I started my career in advertising, would you believe, at the beginning of the 1980s, long, long time. And if you could imagine working in an advertising agency, you can write long, long, long presentations, but actually, if you do a really smart, intelligent diagram, you can just do it on one chart. Now, also bear in mind that when I started doing this stuff, and I wasn't obviously the first person ever to do a diagram, but what might be of interest to some of your listeners is that it's a bit odd to think that for the first 15 years of my career, there was no email and there was no PowerPoint and there were no computers. So in fact, you're essentially using pen and paper or some ancient typewriter. And it's extraordinary. You would often draw a diagram with a black felt pen on a piece of paper and then get somebody, sometimes me, to type up the words that fit around it or on top of it. And then for pitches and so on, often you would turn these into slides, as in conventional ones that would go around in a carousel on a slide projector, or send them off to an artwork house to come back as large poly boards, which were maybe, three or 4 feet wide, big things that you would then carry off to presentations and make. Anyway, so it just explains, if you like, that the value of a diagram became important to me decades ago, essentially. So to try and answer your question, fast forward to now-ish, or at least let's say 10 years ago when I wrote the first version of this book, is that I'd been doing a lot of training. And I noticed in particular about, let's say, 13, 14 years ago, that when you did a diagram in a training session, you got much better levels of attention and engagement from the attendees in the room than if you're just waffling on with words all the time or putting up a bunch of boring other charts. And so I thought, this is interesting. Maybe this is sort of catching on. And then I noticed in the next year or two, actually a lot of students were not writing handwritten notes to the things that I was saying in training, but they were actually doing little diagrams themselves, like little pyramids and things, or circles with arrows coming off and this type of stuff. So I joined all that together and I asked myself a basic question, which was, okay, I do a lot of training schemes. I wonder how many diagrams I've got in all of my stuff. And the answer was 46. And I thought, well, if I find four more, there's a book there. So I stuck that together and showed it to Martin at Lid. And he said, yeah, I think we've got something here. And that is where it all started.
Absolutely. And as you said, that was even more than 10 years ago now. So could you tell us what impact has the book had in those past 10 years for you personally, and then on your readers and those people that you're training?
Sure. There have been all sorts of hilarious things gone on, and it's been a bit of a joy, really. But one of the things that happened after a while was some people started calling me the diagrams guy, which I thought was quite funny because the diagrams, some of them, of course, I've invented myself, but a lot of them are just collected from other places. And I don't think you can really lay claim to a diagram and say, well, that's mine, because what they are is constructs. And it's only when you interpret them, put words in them, and then apply them to a certain subject that they take on a special value and extra meaning. So anyway, but I found that quite funny to be the diagrams guy. But as a thing for me, it's opened up so many opportunities because I've traveled all over the world presenting things and using them all the time. We've solved hundreds and hundreds of big business issues with this type of thinking. And it's just nice, really, then. I've managed to combine the diagrams into all sorts of other training programs. One in particular, my best-selling one, is called From Point of View to Line of Argument. And I combine a lot of these diagrams with stuff from the Ideas book, another one of my books, to make sure that people have a point of view and then they can express it in a really pithy, fast way. And it completely liberates their career because if you can imagine a diligent modern executive taking, I don't know, 10 days to produce an 80-chart presentation, and they're solely fixated on the volume and the conscientious response that they're providing, that it doesn't even occur to them that actually, with one killer diagram, you could explain the entire strategy to the client who would say, thank you, that's marvelous, I get it, and it's approved. So, that training course, we've trained well over 10,000 people in there. And you can imagine all the conversations that go on with that. And every session, we do real projects. And I get feedback from people saying, you know, that thing we did, right? I presented this chart, and the client said, thank God for that. Now, that has saved me 3 hours. I like it instinctively. Please get on with it. And sometimes the answer is, and the agency in question has got 20 million quid as a result of that, just because of a diagram. So all of those things give me a lot of joy, really, because it's very rewarding and it's just because of diagrams.
Yeah, definitely. And then, having sold more than 100,000 copies, why do you think there is such an interest in visual thinking?
Well, I certainly discovered when that reaction occurred that, boy, there really was an entire world market in what we now roughly call visual thinking. But if you think about it historically, if you like, this almost probably goes back to the invention of art and cave paintings. I mean, who knows? But we know that people of old used to write on the wall in caves. That was just a kind of depiction of their environment and animals and all that kind of stuff. And then, of course, people invented language, and there are all sorts of languages which even now experts don't really understand. And you need things like the Rosetta Stone to work out, hang on, what was that alphabet that somebody created? So these are all symbols going back through antiquity, really. Even things like, I believe that they found graffiti, you know, in ancient Rome and things like that. But the broad point about it is that diagrams cross cultural boundaries. You don't have to know 150 different languages to be able to broadly explain something to someone. And when you've got that, then it gets really interesting. And I think that's why. I think the book's come back now in about 20 different languages. And I find that absolutely fascinating because then, if you can imagine, you've written a book and then it comes back in a language that you don't understand, but you do know what the visuals are. And what I always do is I've managed to do it, yes, I think in almost every case, is to find somebody who speaks both languages, who speaks English and speaks Greek or Hungarian or Romanian or whatever, and ask them, could you please just take 20 minutes to glance through that and tell me what was that bit saying there, and how they translated that and this type of thing? And they all come back differently. And it's hilarious. You discover things like, for example, a pie chart in English. The French call le camembert. They call it camembert cheese because it's round. And there is a whole Venn diagram explaining what pie charts are called around the world. So it's just a tiny little example. And then, of course, can you imagine getting something back in Japanese? And you think, well, this is interesting because not only does it read from right to left, which is the opposite of what I do, but also from top to bottom. And so the direction in which things go becomes fascinating. So I'll give a simple example. If you're in the Western world in business, they view time as going from left to right. So the arrow, if you like, always points that way. If you then overlay on top of that the finance director's sort of interminable desire to have everything go upward so that it doesn't look as though you're making a loss, you reasonably conclude that any successful chart in the Western world in business always suggests the direction travel is top right. Whereas if you're doing that in the Arabic world, for example, in Dubai, it might be going top left. So suddenly the structural design of diagrams becomes interesting as an indicator of how people think wherever you're doing your business in the world. So all of that stuff comes together for me to be interesting and helpful. But then again, I guess I'm just interested in diagrams anyway.
Yeah, you surely are, but it's really fascinating to hear how different your diagrams can be viewed in the different languages that they're being translated into. But now let's talk about diagrams in the context of business communication. So why do you think they're so important, and what are the benefits of using diagrams in business?
Right. Well, anyone who knows me also knows that I'm not keen on bullshit because it ruins communication. And so I'm very keen on brevity and clarity. Now, you can't get briefer and clearer than one diagram. And if one diagram can do what 10 or 20 minutes of waffle does, that surely must be a massive benefit to businesses generally and to business communication specifically. We live in a world where bullshit and waffle and even fake news, really, fake claims, is prevalent. It's everywhere. However, if you use one diagram, then you've got nowhere to hide, really. It's either informative and helpful, or it's not, but it's probably a lot clearer than 100 charts of PowerPoint. So, overall, if companies can become so much better at explaining what they're doing, then it's to their benefit. And there's plenty of data which shows that if people understand what a company does very clearly, then sales are probably higher. It's quite interesting. I was watching a study even yesterday, which was explaining that rough stats, 80% now of people buying products want to read the mission statement of the company from which they are buying, but only 20% of them can actually find those mission statements on the company's website. A lot of the time, this is buried deep in tabs low below. You know, here's our sustainability policy or whatever it is, our mission statement. And then what gets really interesting is even when somebody has seen a company's mission statement, only a fraction of them, less than 20%, can correctly attribute the right mission statement to the right brand or company because they're all so vague and similar. But if that were expressed in one clear diagram slash statement, then you've done the job and you've actually made more money for yourself. So I think they have very big implications for businesses.
Yeah, they certainly do. But apart from business, in what other aspects of our lives can we use diagrams to solve problems visually?
That's a nice question. I do know of quite a few people who use what you can call them diagrams if you like, but maybe schematics of some type in order to organize their lives. One of the things that's always fascinated me is when attendees in my training come in and they've got their own personal notebooks. And in those notebooks, if you look over their shoulders, some people's notebooks are extraordinarily brilliant. I mean, obviously, you get people who just scribble random notes and you think, I'm not sure if they know what they're doing tomorrow because it all looks pretty chaotic to me. But other people have amazing, they have color coding systems. They've got ways of doing things with highlighters. They have put grids. They've got one column, two column. They've got different, whatever it is, organizational constructs, let's call them that. So one clear way that people can make themselves happier and feel in control and understanding what they're doing and where the priority lies for the next things they do is through diagrammatic representation of stuff. I guess you might call it a sort of personal version of an entire timing plan for a production schedule, but for the individual. I like, so that's one way of looking at it. I think another way of looking at it could be a bit closer to things like mental health. And what I mean by that is if somebody is stressed, distraught, overwhelmed, not coping well, it is frequently a very powerful thing to get them to write some things down and get them into some sort of shape because it helps their thinking. And this is something we do quite a lot with things like the Excellence Book, another one of ours, whereby you're getting people to say, well, this is difficult for me. You talk to them about it. You work through some possibilities. You may do pros and cons. You may get them into some areas that are more helpful than others. It's similar also to daughter Rosie's The Early Career Book. It is helping people organize their thinking, and the result is that they feel more confident about what they think, and it helps them in their work. And frequently visual constructs can help them achieve that just with a pen and paper. It's massively helpful, I think.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And then I think it's worth mentioning here that at the end of the new 10th anniversary edition of the Diagrams book, you've got a list of diagrams which might be helpful in specific situations and problems you might be facing. So yeah, I think that's very useful for our listeners who might buy the book. But now let's talk about that new edition. Could you tell us more about the new stuff that it's in it and what readers can expect to find inside the pages?
Sure. I always have a bit of a chuckle when publisher says, oh, can you do another one of these, please? Or there's an anniversary coming up or whatever, whatever. We want more material for the trade. And so these things, they tend to get bigger to suggest that there's new stuff. And I understand that. However, that can often lead to what you might call scope creep, where a really good, short, pithy book eventually then becomes kind of fat and bloated because people are demanding more stuff, but nobody really knows why, and it potentially could make the book worse. So whenever I look at these things, I think, right, we've got to keep this quality really high. So the way this started was 50 diagrams. When we did the fifth anniversary version, I added 10 more, a section on new material. And so when the challenge was up to do a 10th anniversary thing, I thought, dare I, should I make it as big as 100? Because I thought if you're going to do it properly, there's quite a nice symmetry between 10 years and 100 diagrams. So to cut a long story short, it's a bit like with bullshit where people send me stuff all the time and I collect it. It's the same with diagrams. People send me diagrams. So I looked at my entire sort of ideas file and I thought, yeah, I do have another 40 of these. What am I going to do with them? And I was then reminded that in the original book, and I'll be honest, and I cannot remember why, but I organized the material by shape. And so part one was about triangles and pyramids and anything roughly that shape. And then the next one was squares and axes. And then we had circles and pi. So it was a very shape-based thing. And so I worked quite hard to get 20 examples instead of 10 into each of these shaped-based sections. And then, as you rightly say, yeah, cross-reference them at the back. So if you want a diagram that deals with one of these topics like creativity or decision making or efficiency, then you just go to the relevant pages and hopefully get some inspiration. So that's the background to all of that. I guess you're probably going to ask me now from some examples of new stuff that's in there. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's what people want to hear.
Yeah. Well, this is where it becomes quite subjective because I've got no idea what people like, but I can tell people some two or three examples of what I've put in the new one, which I found interesting. So first up, there is a thing called the Ishikawa fishbone diagram. And Mr. Ishikawa was a very intelligent guy in Japan, not surprisingly, academic folk. And if you can picture a fishbone, that's pretty simple for people. You've got the backbone of the fish and then the ribs, if you like, coming off to one side. But if you could then imagine taking one of those side ribs and then doing another one on it, and then another line and another line. And what this guy is essentially saying is too many business issues are examined, if you like, in too simplistic a way. And if you only go down to one level, let's call that the bones of the fish, the ribs, you may not really have understood the issue as deeply as you probably should do. Therefore, you need to go down to the next level. So it's really a tiered series of questions. Does it, when we get to this level, can we think of what that involves? Oh, hang on, there's another offshoot from that, which is like a little flow diagram, and then off and off and away. And you end up with this thing that's like a whole tessellation of layers of bones. And then you can work out, there's a flaw down here in this project, which has the capacity to derail the whole thing. But if we hadn't thought about it to that fourth level down or so, or whatever level, we wouldn't have ever realized it. So I like that. So I've given a couple of examples in the book of how to use that. Another one I really like, it's a little bit cheesy, but I like the visual imagery of it. And I called it the innovation shark's fin. So if you picture a shark's fin poking above the waterline, which everybody can, that is a metaphor, if you like, for the peak in popularity of a new product that you've just launched. And particularly in markets like technology, unfortunately for them, it's a massive craze and then it falls away very fast. Hence, it's like a pointy peak. This is, by the way, I'm always chuckling at this, of course. The irony is not lost on me doing an audio podcast about visual subject matter. So, in every instance, I have to describe because we can't put up a picture saying, there you go, you can see it immediately. Anyway, the shark's fin is a metaphor for something being massively popular fast and then falling away. And it's not necessarily the fault of the product, it may just mean that it's such a smart idea that competitors have come in at speed. And so your particular sales suddenly start going down off that peak because you've suddenly got two or three competitors that you didn't have when you started it. So the idea is then, instead of just saying, oh, this is great, we've got a massive success here with a peak of sales, and then sort of wallowing in that warm glory. If you're an intelligent company, what you do is you're happy with that for a very, very brief moment, but you immediately start working on your next metaphorical shark's fin so that you don't lose the advantage of that. And if you then repeat that three or four times across a year or 4 years or whatever, you can picture four shark's fins in a row. And that's why they call it's a bit cheesy, staying ahead of the shark, to make sure that you are consistently successful with innovations and new products rather than just having a one-hit wonder. So I like that bit of thinking.
Fascinating. Thank you very much for sharing those, Kevin. And of course, our listeners can grab a copy of the book if they want to check out the other new content that's in this new edition. But now I've got one final question for you. In the foreword of the book, Chris Hayes says that everyone will have their favorite diagrams. So, Kevin, what's your favorite diagram or diagrams?
Yeah, well, it's really hard for me to answer this one because to have just one is difficult. I came up with there are several. They crop up all the time when I use one. One of my most favorite is what I call the student essay crisis. And if you can picture a flat line, you're given the brief for your essay on a Monday, you've got a week to do it. And on the flat line, you do absolutely nothing. Nothing on that project or essay or whatever it is you've got. You go to the pub, you go out, party, sports, social, everything. And then at the last minute, there's a huge jaggedy flurry. That's lines going up, down, up, down, up, down, like a heart monitor going wrong when you have a massive panic and a deep rush to get that work done for the deadline at the very last minute. Now, if you can picture in your mind, do that back to front. You should do all the jaggedy, difficult stuff straight away and then have a smooth line to execution. That is the correct way. And if you compare that culturally, it's hilarious because disorganized cultures do the essay crisis. They sort of hang around, go to lunch, do nothing, leave it to the last minute. Whereas fantastically organized cultures, like the Japanese, for example, do all the tough thinking at the beginning and then have an orderly run to their launch day. So that has always been one of my favorite. And I've never met anybody that I've showed that to who has not found it very, it resonates basically, because everybody tends to want to do that. But when you discuss it with them, they realize that not only is it pretty useless in a personal context, but it's a utterly useless in a business context. So that's one of my favorites. Another one I really like is one called the motivational dip. And this is essentially a line which rises from the base up high very fast and reaches a little peak or crescendo at the top, and then it falls away again. But it's not like the shark's fin because it falls about halfway down on the right-hand side and then it kind of flattens out and we can decide what the ending of the story is in a second. But basically, if you take a very excited, artistic-y type of person and you give them a brief on a Monday, they will probably say, "Oh, right, this is really this is great. I like this. It's interesting. It's exciting. I'm enthusiastic about it." The question then is, how long will it take them to think, "Oh God, this is really boring. I've got no motivation on this at all." And in the case of some designers and people like that, the answer could be Tuesday lunchtime. They're already bored with the thing, right? Then they've got to work out, okay, how am I going to create a degree of learning and understanding which enables me to produce an excellent response to this thing before I decide that, oh, there's no point bothering with it at all. And of course, ideally, at the end of the flat line, it should be going up to a level of success as opposed to down to a level of failure. Every time I show that to somebody, they look back at me and there's a little twinkle in the eye and say, "Have you ever had a relationship like that?" And everybody laughs because that's the boyfriend I was really excited about. And 1 week later, and so there's a human point to it, as usual. And then there's a work, motivation and effort point to it as well. So that's a favorite of mine. And the other ones that I like actually are the humorous ones. And I do put quite a few of these in. My daughter sent me a fantastic one once, and it just says in a box, are you being a dick? And the one box says no, in which case carry on, and the other one says, if it says yes, then it says stop being a dick, and then it just goes back round the loop, and it's just an absolute joy, that one. And and more recently I've had one which is in the new book, yeah, is do flowcharts help explain things? And then it just flows round and it kind of says no and goes back where it was. So you can get a lot of humor in charts as well. There you go.
Yeah, you definitely have. But thank you very much, Kevin, for this very insightful and entertaining conversation. And I would encourage our listeners to, of course, get a copy of the new 10th anniversary edition of the Diagrams book so they can take a look at all of the new materials that's there, all 40 new diagrams. But thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. Enjoyed it. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Make sure you keep an eye on our social media at Lit Publishing on LinkedIn, X, Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook for more information about new books and podcasts with thought leaders. See you next time on Lit Radio Podcast.